Welcome to Tuning Healthcare by Lumaris. My name is Nigel Orenstein, one of the co-founders of Lumaris, the market leader in value-based care. In these podcasts, we will talk to leaders from across the healthcare spectrum and learn how they are tackling real issues in healthcare today. Join me as we chat to different pioneers and discover their journey, what motivates them, and how they are solving some of the most pressing topics facing the US healthcare system. I'm joined today by Ryan Panchadsaram, a highly accomplished executive. Ryan is currently a partner at Kleiner Perkins and the former Deputy Chief Technology Officer of the United States. In this episode of Tuning Healthcare, we discuss data transparency, how healthcare services will evolve, and Ryan's advice for budding entrepreneurs. Join Ryan and me in Kleiner Perkins' San Francisco office for this episode of Tuning Healthcare. Joined today by Ryan Panchadsaram in the Kleiner offices in San Francisco. It's a sunny day here and beautiful to be here. Ryan, thanks for joining me.
Always. Thank you, Nigel.
So I must admit that I thought I was quite accomplished until I read your bio. Any one of those things you've achieved would be impressive in of itself. But looking back, which experience gives you the best feeling? What do you feel like, wow, I really did something amazing here?
That's a hard question. I mean, each of those experiences on their own were so meaningful, right? I mean, I think it's the beautiful part about working in government is that you're working on really important problems that matter. And if you can make a difference to them, it feels really good. But if I had to pick one, it would likely be the healthcare.gov rescue. I think as a technologist in government, working on a problem like that, which meant every bug you fixed meant someone got healthcare, I'd never been so close to where tech was fixing the problem so viscerally, right? Like you could see the number of people getting enrolled. You could see the number of people signing up for plans, and it meant a lot. And being able to be a part of that and to support the implementation of the Affordable Care Act afterwards, like, it felt great. It really did.
It's truly amazing. So how did that team come about?
Yeah.
Right. How, I mean, there were 7, 8 of you that were sort of core, right? The, on the picture of time of people who fixed healthcare.gov. Take us through what was happening.
Of course.
The sky was falling.
The sky was falling. I mean, you know, you got to remember October 1st, 2013 is when the site launched. That was set into motion just, you know, 3 years earlier in March 2010, right? The Affordable Care Act gets signed. It says in it, as part of this, there's going to be a website that helps enroll people into quality health plans. And when it went live, it was this massive waterfall-style project that asked for everything to appear on that day. And not just that, no one had ever used the site publicly before that day. You had 20 plus contractor organizations all trying to integrate the weeks before that day. And so October 1st ended up not being a great day. If you kind of go back even through my Twitter feed, I think I congratulated the team on that day for the launch, because from our perspective, it was going to be a great day. What ended up happening is millions of people, of course, visited the site. Hundreds of thousands of folks tried to apply. And I think only 6 people were actually able to get through on that first day. It kind of just was a testament of how bad and broken it was. But we weren't asked to help for a good 17 days. You know, you have this site on the news 24/7, not working. And I was working at the White House at the time for Todd Park. And so a lot of us were trying to find ways to help. But because of the government shutdown, we couldn't. And so it took a little while to get the wheels moving, but we, you know, ended up at the scene at the middle to end of October, first as an assessment team for the White House to find out if we could fix it. And then after we spent a really exhausting weekend trying to see how we could, we realized there could be a path to doing it. And it took a lot of teamwork. It took a lot of aligning the thousands of people that are already working on it towards fixing the problem. And we could spend a whole hour together talking about it. But the best thing about that story is what happened actually afterwards, right? Post the crisis, post fixing healthcare.gov, you had a government that was very aware of the role of technology to future policy, right? Anything that we wanted to accomplish in government, no matter how big or small, tech was going to play a small part. And so because of that, we started the United States Digital Service to recruit amazing technologists to work in government, to partner with their colleagues that were great policymakers to ensure these projects and policies were successful. I think in healthcare, we have that similar analogy, right? The best healthcare companies are ones that have great clinical teams paired up with great technologists, paired up with great policymakers. And I think those are the kinds of companies that end up being successful in the healthcare space.
So if we look back at that time in healthcare and the government, obviously made enormous strides to helping to push healthcare along, right? I mean, healthcare is in so many ways a backward industry compared to all the other sort of great investments that you're working with here at Kleiner. And as we also know in healthcare, the government leads and the commercial industry follows. But meaningful use,
yeah,
right? Tens of billions, right, spent on meaningful use. Good use of money? Would you do it differently if you went again?
Was it a good use of money? I would say yes, but no, right? Yes, we needed to digitize. I don't think there would have been any other way to convince the hundreds of thousands of doctors across the country to make that shift, right? A lot of them are running really great practices, but the benefits of digitization and why that $40 billion went behind it was really stuck in kind of this RAND report that said, if you were able to digitize, we as a healthcare system would achieve all these great efficiencies. We'd have great measures at the national level, but at the individual level, we'd be able to take care of you better. So on that front, yes, it was well spent to get the digitization to happen. But I think, you know, the execution part is where it could have absolutely have been better, right? I think that meaningful use was never strict enough. And I always get kind of like ragged for that, because it's like, if you think about what meaningful use asks for, the bar is kind of low in what it needs if you want to create a great electronic health record. And so I always felt meaningful use should have asked more. For $40 billion, it should have asked for more. But I also think, you know,
maybe interoperability.
Especially on interoperability. and I think there are ways to approach interoperability from like a practical point of view, maybe more of an academic point of view. And I think we forget that for interoperability to be done well, it does take some sort of central coordination. And so part of me feels that that's the role of government. And so I think that we needed ONC to be able to do more. But in many ways, they were handcuffed, right? Industry would push back on them. Folks in government would push back on them. I just wish ONC was able to do what it could on the more coordinating side. Because then I think we would actually have gotten even more value out of this system.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The digitization, obviously necessary, but for $40 billion, right, a little bit of interoperability would have been nice.
Absolutely.
And we, as well as other companies, spend a fortune of time and effort, integrating different data sources, making EMRs talk to each other. It's incredibly frustrating, right? As you well know, one version of Epic doesn't talk to another version of Epic, and it's enormous amount of time, money, and dollars spent doing that.
Absolutely. I the thing to like that I'm so inspired by is actually the energy from industry in trying to fix this. You know, if there was some energy to maybe slow it down back when MU2 was coming together, MU3 and the other regs post were really about saying, hey, let industry figure this out, right? Efforts like Project Argonaut to like strengthen FHIR and to get the EHRs to come to the table and to look at that group that was part of Argonaut, it was all the big players, right? And so seeing that was really powerful. I mean, the other effect was seeing other companies like an Apple come into the picture and say, hey, this FHIR thing's kind of cool. You know, if we're going to create a health app on our phone that's super private, we need to make these APIs work. And so I think in some ways, you know, Argonaut got everyone to talk in a similar language, but Apple helped say, well, this is the quality bar. You know, we're not going to integrate in our prestigious app on our phone if you don't meet a certain bar. And I thought that was really powerful because guess what? Every hospital CEO has in their pocket, likely an iPhone. And so, you know, they can physically take this thing out and say, why does my EHR not work with this? And that driving factor, even more powerful than anything I think a government could.
Undoubtedly. And that talks a little bit to the private sector, public sector partnership, right? And you bring a unique perspective here, right? You've worked for many years in public service, and now obviously at Kleiner on the private side. What's the optimal way that the public and private sector come together to help transform healthcare care quicker? Because from my perspective, this is so critical for our children and our grandchildren, right? Absolutely. It's not just about healthcare. America becomes uncompetitive in the world if our healthcare costs continue to rise at the rate it does. So it's almost, we have to fix it.
Yeah.
I'd love your perspective on how does public and private do it? And maybe as part of that, what do you see as sort of the Amazon Berkshire, what role do you see them playing in this in this transformation?
Two very, very different questions, but two very big ones. I would say role of public and private. They both have to, like, the public sector and private sector need to both do the hard thing, right? The hard thing for, I think, the public sector is how do you create an equitable healthcare system? How do you ensure there are no bad actors that are in it? Whether you are a tech provider or a pharmaceutical company, how do you even there's a lot about equity and access that I think government really needs to be the torchbearer on, because that's the hard problem that they can solve. They can also be the central coordinator for things that need to be coordinated. And it's equally important for the private sector to do the hard thing, right? That starts with how do you build and invent the next new drug, the next new therapy, the next new device, the next new way to take care of large populations, right? Like, how do you deliver care better? Like, that the private sector is phenomenally good at, because there's competition. There's a market that really celebrates that. I think there might be this trend and thought that, well, doesn't the private sector make everything really expensive? And I think, no, it's not always true. I think there's only two places where trickle-down theory works. And to me, it's in healthcare and technology, right? Like, in both industries, you come up with the next best thing. It starts off expensive because you pour a lot of effort into it. And as time goes on, it becomes cheaper and it then reaches the masses. And so if the public sector can keep things equitable and that level playing field and be that coordinator, while the private sector is about delivery today and delivery tomorrow in the best way possible, I think you've got the best balance.
So we're sitting in San Francisco, the innovation capital of the world. I mean, it's unreal what's come out of a relatively small area that has transformed almost every part of how we live our life. But a lot of what Silicon Valley is and San Francisco and the tech industry have done immensely well is go straight to the consumer, right? Cut out the middleman, mm-hmm. and activate the consumer. Uber's a short, stone's throw from here, right? They've figured out how to go directly from myself when I get off a plane to get the car I need, as opposed to ringing some third party car service and et cetera, et cetera. How do you do that in healthcare?
Yeah.
You do it in healthcare?
Ooh, great question. How, and then can you? Right. And the flip, I think, is can you do it in healthcare? For most of it, I think the answer is no. But for parts of it, you can. The parts you can't do it for is when you have no choice. You know, when you go to that emergency room, when you have that moment where you are in a healthcare emergency, you don't have choice in that kind of situation. And even if it's of an elective procedure, or maybe you can shop around a little bit in some degree, it's really hard there because it's a very low, you only have access to the things around you, right? You can't order a knee surgery online and have it get delivered to you, right? And so I think if you don't have choice, then no. In those places, there's no market, and we have to be really thoughtful about that. But there are a lot of places where you do have choice. And I think that's where you are seeing more consumer-oriented models popping up and having patients and consumers picking. You know, I think you're seeing this trend in clinics happen where you have a choice, right? One Medical that is offering things around convenience and access, because as a patient, you want that. And so you sign up and you pay for that kind of membership. You have groups like Forward or TIA, which are pushing that even farther. Forward on this more holistic sense, TIA for women's healthcare. It's like, how do you, and in those cases, you have choice up front because it isn't urgent. And so I think there is a market and a consumer nest to those parts of the equation. And I think that's where you can learn from the Ubers and Airbnbs and of the world. It's a lot harder on the other side when you have to go for these acute, these issues, if you get diagnosed with cancer, you don't have the same kind of choice. So,
right. So you know, expanding on that a little bit, right? We roll the clock back. I lose track of time, but let's say roll the clock like 20 years. It's almost inconceivable that you would have gone anywhere other than the mall to buy sneakers, mm-hmm. right? Or shoes, right? And now today you just, you know, have five pairs sent to you and you send four back, right? And you do that from your home at midnight. And, you know, IKEA, another great model, mm-hmm. right? Took over things that were historically the domain of the supplier, right? To deliver it to your front door, to put it together. I mean, it was be unheard of that you would have said, hey, I'm gonna push those jobs onto the consumer. What jobs can we push to the consumer? And particularly as you think about, I know it's a buzzword, right? But think about the advancement of artificial intelligence, right? What jobs do you think we can push to the consumer that can occur outside of the hospital setting, outside of the doctor setting, in the home, with support of AI, even maybe the advancements of robotics? As you say, they're expensive now, but chances are they're going to become cheaper. What things do you think will potentially happen outside of the expensive medical center? Sort of, if you think of like IKEA or the mall changing over time.
Maintenance and triage, without a doubt, those have to happen more and more in the home with the person, with the individual, right? When I say maintenance, I mean, it's all the things that if I had to go in for this visit, could I be doing them at home instead? If I am supposed to take care of myself better to prevent some escalation from happening, are there inputs because of new sensors or new tests that I can take, right? So that's on the maintenance side. On the triage side, that I think is where there's a lot of getting that overutilization of healthcare in the physical presence of a provider to being pushed to the home, right? Where you can get diagnostic tests done at the home. You can get triages done via text message or a video call. Like, I think if there are ways to do things at the home, the successful ones are more asynchronous than synchronous, right? Like telemedicine at home, maybe not as efficient because it still taxes a doctor's time in the same way, but text message threads, taking diagnostics on your own, things collecting on sensors are all asynchronous. And so that's where I see a lot of the magic happening.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. As you think about where Lumaris plays, right? Mm-hmm. Lumaris plays in the evolution of particularly health systems to value-based care, right? And we're incredibly excited by where the market is now. We've spent a lot of time waiting for the market, and the market's really arrived, and that's truly exciting. I think not only for Lumaris, but obviously for healthcare and particularly for patients. But in this sort of transformation to value-based care, there inevitably have to be some winners and some losers, right? Mm-hmm. We've made a bet on health systems, which some people think is a bit odd because they're under pressure, right? My personal perspective is is the payers are going to be losers unless they change rapidly. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But how do you see it from your vantage point? Obviously, you've, again, what I love about the perspective you bring, Ryan, right, is you've had the government perspective, but now you're like in the heart of you know, perhaps the best investment firm in the world, right?
This shift to value-based care, I mean, the exciting part is that the system wins if it's done well, right? And when I say the system, I think patients win first, right? I think providers win because they're using their time in very meaningful ways. And the core payer wins, right? Like the actual person that's spending the dollar. You know, when you talk about the losers in this system, it is the folks that you could consider to be the inefficiencies, and it happens everywhere. And so the hope and desire is that by shifting and pushing these kinds of models, all these efficiencies come to play as well as all these improvements. And so to your point of like the Lumeris approach that goes closer to hospital systems, to me, that makes a lot of sense because it's where the care is happening. You know, if you look at the most successful kinds of companies that are being founded now in healthcare and even outside, it's the ones that are taking on more risk, right? Risk in like every sense, not just risk in like the healthcare sense. And so it's owning more of the problem, being more aware of everything that's happening. And in a healthcare system, that really rests on the shoulders of these provider systems. And so giving them more tools, giving them more incentives, giving them everything they need to take care of that person in the moment is a powerful approach, right? And so anyone who's putting that patient first with that efficiency mindset of getting them to be the healthiest they can and not pointing them to excess waste, those are the winners. And I think the losers in this system, when they lose, we're not going to miss them, right? Because they're not the ones actually making this system better. And so it'll be very, very fascinating to see. And I think these changes are going to happen quickly.
So quickly, what does that mean in healthcare, right? Healthcare breaks your heart.
Yeah.
Right, literally, right, and figuratively, right? It seems to take forever for healthcare to change. They're entrenched forces that almost try and prevent change. So what is quickly? What do you think, what does that look like?
That's a great question. Quickly looks like the bad actors changing, right? And the bad actors changing first, I think for them, the ones that realize and wake up that the old model's not working and they have to be the first to change, those ones are going to be the winners because they'll understand how their space is supposed to look and change and then absorb and get that market share. I think the ones that end up losing, quote unquote, in this kind of, if you want to call it a game, are the ones that don't adapt too quickly, the ones that think that their fiefdoms will be that way, the ones that don't understand that all the lines are blurring now, right? The lines between a provider to a payer to what a patient is supposed to do is all changing. Each of them are taking on more of the problem. And so if you don't actively do that now, you will be left behind because you'll only be targeting like a small little point solution when the shift to value is requiring each of us to do more, payer, provider, and patient.
So deputy, you know, chief technology officer of the United States, which is a pretty cool title. And I think any title of the United States is a pretty cool title. And then you chose to come to Kleiner. I imagine you could have gone anywhere, right? Almost in the world, right? After that, why here? What excites you about what you're doing here? Why here as opposed to anywhere else?
I mean, the work at the White House was inspiring and motivating on two fronts. One was not only helping government to be more effective, but our office was also responsible for lifting up entrepreneurs all across the country, right? Celebrating their successes, celebrating their industries, like waving the flag that this is where innovation happens. In thinking about what I wanted to do next, I mean, you know, you can celebrate these industries or you can help, you know, roll up your sleeves and put the capital behind them. And so at a place like Kleiner Perkins, where we invest in disruptive technologies that are changing industries or even creating new industries, I mean, there was no better fit for what I wanted to do next. I think the beauty of this space and the ability to work with the chairman here, John Doerr, you know, the purview of what we want to change is bigger than just the consumer and enterprise market. It's also what's happening in healthcare, what's happening to our education system, what's happening to our climate. And I think as engineers, we are so motivated to find ways to solve these problems. And a for-profit model is one of them. But as John and I also believe, you have these nonprofit levers and advocacy levers as well, too. And if we can harness all of those to make good in the world, then I think we are making the best of our time here.
I know. And I have not met anybody who thinks bigger than John.
So true.
When I first had the privilege of meeting him when I came to this company, the scale at which he thinks, the vision is unparalleled. But what advice do you give to entrepreneurs, right? So as you think about you have these entrepreneurs that are trying to change the world, we're faced with operational challenges. We're faced with sort of some of the entrenched forces that we already spoke about in healthcare and obviously in other industries as well. We're faced with, you know, building sales at the same time. I mean, the list of things that potentially sinks an entrepreneur along. What advice do you give to entrepreneurs, and what advice would you give as you think about and interact with all these entrepreneurs on a daily basis?
Yeah, this advice that I give is, you know, applies both to entrepreneurs in the for-profit and nonprofit space, right? Social entrepreneurs too. I think both groups of people are trying to change the world with a new organization that they're kind of starting, right? And so, I mean, of course, the first charge is to be ambitious and audacious. You know, the next organization you build just can't be 10% better. It has to be 10 times better. And only when it's 10 times better are you going to get people to switch and use you and adopt you and come to you and work for you and all of those kinds of things. I think the second piece of advice also is to fix a problem you know well. And I think that's really important. We like to sometimes solve problems that we see from afar, but if we don't know it well, then, you know, how are you going to solve it? And so if you don't know it well, how do you build a team around you that are subject matter experts of that particular problem? The third one really is kind of a reminder that John always says is to be thoughtful about your finances and your financing, right? You know, the business model you have is super important. And so being thoughtful of that up front for both a for-profit and nonprofit, but also what do you need to do with respect to your next raise, right? You have this desire to grow your organization. So how much capital do you need? Be thoughtful about that. And then the last bit, which is a true Johnism, which is ideas are easy and execution's everything. I think the piece there is about setting goals and achieving them, right? As entrepreneurs, we're building things out of nothing yet, you know, so we see the world in this beautiful way, but you can preach what the world should look like, but the best entrepreneurs don't just preach, they actually do and practice and create. And so...
So that last one resonates well, in particular for me. I remember when we closed our very first Lumaris deal and I got an email from John that said, congratulations, now let's go execute, right? which talked to that. So let's come back to data transparency,
yes.
Right?
My favorite subject.
Right?
It really is.
So where do we go from here? How do we get to, I mean, it still pretty much exists today that... that when I go to a doctor, I still don't really know how much it's going to cost. If I'm going to have a procedure that involves, you know, a physician, an anesthesiologist, et cetera, I really don't have visibility to cost. I don't have visibility really to quality. Still remains very much a word of mouth. I ring a doctor. Does a doctor truly know how well another doctor does, or is it just a friendship that they've been, you know, they went to medical school together and so they know the people they know. And so they refer to the people they know. Where do we go from here with data transparency?
Yeah. this quest of data transparency, it's, well, what is it for, right? I mean, if we want this true value-based healthcare system, we won't be able to achieve it without data transparency, right? I think value-based care at the highest spiritual level is getting more ownership of the outcome from the people that take care of us, right? Like, there's that bit there, but then there's all the tactics behind it, right? And a big part is, well, what are the analytics around what's being paid? Who's doing what? How do you build the tools that actually drive more engagement? How do you improve the EHRs? How do you get better drug pricing? How do you get all these, all of these things require data to kind of feed and fuel them. And so Meaningful You started the train. And I should always say, like, people have done incredible work to get us where we are. And there's all these outside forces that are stopping some of these changes from happening. And so what's next to keep this data transparency thing rolling? I mean, I'm one of the big advocates that we need some sort of unique ID for all of our healthcare data. And there are ways to do it where I can choose when to use my unique ID and when I can choose not to be part of this system. But I think it's super important for all of my stuff to tie together. Because if it's not, how does my care team know exactly what's happened to me, right? If they can't pull that data back. I think for more data transparency, we need more structured data and more sources of data as well, too. You know, EHRs are the operating system. That's what my doc sees when they see me. And so how do I make sure that there's more structure in that, but also that they can see more data, maybe from my Apple Watch or my blood pressure cuff or any other sensor I have on the outside? How does it go to them? And so, you know, with this unique ID, they have access to all my information. And then with more structure, they can start to do more with that information. And then now when that's going, let me pump more information to you. So you as a clinician can do more, but you as a technologist and entrepreneur can do some really neat things with it as well too.
So do you see a world, hopefully in the not too distant future, where maybe analogy is a brokerage account, right? I might have a portal and I pull in all my different sources, right? So I have one view of my financial situation. I bring in my 401k, I bring in, right? And I have that view and I could give access to a spouse. I could give access to a caregiver, right? A kid. Is that sort of the vision? We own our healthcare data, which obviously HIPAA gave us the right to own our healthcare data. Yes. Whether we've delivered on HIPAA's intent is another question. It's really sort of still housed in the provider setting in each different provider setting. But is that sort of a vision? Is that what you mean by having a unique identifier so I can put in all my healthcare data into sort of one portal, and then I can choose to give, Dr. X access or not, as you said, if you choose not to for whatever reason?
Something very much like that. I think if you want to pull it into that brokerage, you can. But the idea is that if I end up in an emergency room and they see me and they know my, unique ID, they can pull my records from wherever they are across the country and get that on my behalf so they can take care of me in the best way possible. Today, it's this amalgamation of send out 18 things about Ryan to find these matches. Weirdly, the reason why we don't have a unique ID today is because of privacy reasons, right? We say that we want this to be, it's about privacy. Yet today, to do patient matching, we share so much data to get these matches to actually happen. HIPAA originally had the request and ask for a unique ID, and it got blocked for privacy reasons and things like that were thrown. But I think we're to a point where you talk to the folks from Estonia who have a unique ID, and they say by having a unique ID, that's the only thing that's being pushed around. And so they actually feel like it's more private and they actually know when people access their records. So they have more visibility. Today, you and I and all of our records, they're flying.
Right. Almost like I can put an alert on my credit card that anyone of my family that spends more than $10 or something, I get an alert, right? And so anytime, right, we get hundreds of emails alerts from our financial institutions, but we don't get any
for ourselves. I mean, it's a brilliant idea, right? It's like for myself, but for your loved one, right? Like as a new parent, it's like, wouldn't it be great if I got a flag for, for things like that, or, you know, when you're taking care of your parents, this whole dealt, like, we could do so much, like data transparency combined with entrepreneurs, combined with more flexible payment models to incentivize all these things wanting to happen, I think is, you know, are the ingredients, right? These are the ingredients Todd Park preaches. These are the ingredients that John Doerr preaches. And it's like, you can see how those ingredients create this future that we want, which is a better healthcare system.
Great. From a, as you look at the, from a healthcare perspective, as you look at the Democrat field, any candidates get you excited or too early to tell?
For me, I think it's too early to tell, but the beautiful part is healthcare is being talked about by all of them, right? I mean, healthcare, I think, will be an issue on the stage for both all the Democratic candidates as well as the Republican candidate as well, too. And that's really special. And so the question that I'm asking myself is, you know, will someone do, whoever gets elected, will they do something meaningful to healthcare within those first 100 days? You know, President Obama did it in his first term. Can we do something with healthcare in the first 100 days? And which candidate is going to be willing to do that? Because I think from the Affordable Care Act, we saw this shift of like all this good happening where, you know, people aren't losing healthcare because of pre-existing conditions and so forth. And all this good changes happen, but it's still not done yet, right? Like there are a lot of things that can be improved with the ACA. And so someone's got to be elected and do it. Whether you're a Republican or Democrat, like I think it's important for that to happen. And I think it could happen within the first 100 days. I think we're, as a country, so much more aware of how government plays in our healthcare than I think we were 10 years ago.
Undoubtedly. Medicare for all?
I'm a big fan of Medicare for all. With that said, I also believe that you have to figure out how that works with private options as well, too. And so can you have Medicare for all as an option, right? The public option was missing as part of the Affordable Care Act piece. I think competition on how we provide care is going to be so important. And I think the government deserves to compete as well too, right? Because they can either do it so much better than everybody else or show that this is a really hard problem in being a player in this.
Right. The exciting thing from my perspective is that not only are both parties talking about healthcare, but to my mind, the value-based care train has left the station and no one's really talking about turning it back. And mm-hmm. so that's pretty exciting. So we like to end with a little quick fire round of questions. Best piece of business advice you were ever given?
Ooh. So we talked about ideas that are easy and execution's everything. I'd say the other John-ism that I love is you make plans and then you make those plans.
Favorite thing to do when not at work?
Right now it's playing with my 8-month old. He's the smiliest, biggest bundle of joy that my wife and I have right now. And so it's just so much fun to see him every day.
That's great. Will a major payer or health system go the way of Kodak or BlackBerry in the next 10 years where we look back and say, hey, remember that payer or remember that health system?
Absolutely. Who? I'm not sure yet, but without a doubt.
Favorite business book?
Ooh, I have to make a plug for Measure What Matters. Helping John put that together was so much fun to see the stories from different kinds of businesses. And Lumaris is in there as well, too. And if I had to pick a book outside of Measure What Matters, you know, for business, I think Andy Grove in his book called High Output Management is so practical and so wonderful. And when I say business, I mean any type of organization, whether you're a for-profit or nonprofit. Measure What Matters and Andy Grove's High Output Management are fantastic books.
Yeah, no, I love the way you've tied together the for-profit side and the not-for-profit side and how they actually have to work together. I've actually given Measure What Matters to a number of people in the not-profit side and said, this applies equally to what you do, yes, as well as it does to the for-profit business side.
There's nothing, you know, setting audacious goals and describing how you're going to achieve them is something that applies to everybody and even governments too. And so if I had a dream, it's, you know, when we set the next kind of regs for meaningful use, whatever it ends up looking like, what if a set of OKRs could be applied to them, right? Or any of these policies that we put out, you know, we have this grand objective, but what are the key results that show that that was successful? And so I think it could be a powerful, powerful lens for policymaking.
Great. Ryan, thank you for joining me today. I think we could probably chat for hours on these topics, but really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to chat to me about it.
Always. Thanks for coming to San Francisco.
Thank you.